Hello, thanks for listening again. This is Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, along with Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. Our weekly program is Health and Happiness, here on KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. The Public Education Committee of the Montana Psychological Association provides support for our presentation, and our focus is on health and happiness, in particular, mental health. Suzanne will now introduce today's program.
The United States. Today, we rank 35th out of 169 countries in our healthiness as a nation. And we're the 11th richest, yet we pay more for medical care in the U.S., 16.9, almost 17% of our gross national product goes to health care, going up to 19% in the next few years, whereas Switzerland, ranked second, only pays 12.2%. New Zealand and Australia, who have excellent health care, which we've experienced firsthand, sit at 9%. We pay more, and yet we are the highest in chronic diseases, and we have two times the obesity rates. We also, unfortunately, rank highest in hospitalizations for preventable diseases and for avoidable deaths. We spend more than any other high-income country for medical care, but we also have the lowest life expectancy. That's perhaps the grim news. On a hopeful note, we have with us today a health and wellness expert who is working very hard to change these alarming statistics. Welcome to Dr. Joseph Sofianek from Bozeman Health, a person who's targeting wellness in our Gallatin Valley. It seems, Joe, that we really do need to talk with you today.
Well, hey, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners, and thanks for that great intro for setting the stage of our country's woes when it comes to healthcare we're delivering or not delivering. So yeah, I really appreciate the chance to be here and speak with everybody today.
Tell us about how you got started along these lines as a doctor and then as one specializing in wellness along with your other medical duties.
Well, sure. So went into medical school actually thinking I was going to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. I'd done some work at the NIH and thought that was my calling. And when I got to do the breadth of rotations in med school, I really came to understand that I like the whole person type of care the family practice delivers and the longitudinal relationship that you develop with your patients doing that. So again, I went through medical school, went through family practice residency, and then began practice here in Bozeman in 1997. You know, doing pretty standard full-spectrum family practice medicine in the hospital, delivering babies the whole bit. Several years ago, I had a little sense of, I guess, dis-ease. I was becoming a little more frustrated with the chronic conditions that we see and treat on a daily basis, oftentimes with medications, and knew deep down that there was another approach. There were preventive approaches, and then there were other ancillary approaches to help people manage chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension, elevated cholesterol, as some examples. It would typically be somebody would come into my office maybe with a new diagnosis of hypertension, and I would talk with them about medications. And then as an aside, I might say, oh, and here's a diet that's been proven to help. I would hand them a sheet of paper and basically wish them good luck. And as you can imagine, the return on that little bit of investment really wasn't that great. Every once in a while, somebody would read the information I gave them and have their own self-efficacy to institute some of those changes. And when they came back and did, I thought I was a great doctor. But what I realized is 99 times out of 100, they weren't able to do that. So I started looking into other ways to approach these chronic diseases. And that's when I kind of came along and found lifestyle medicine. So that's a specialty in and of its own. They've been offering board certification exams since about 2017. There's been an American College of Lifestyle Medicine since 2004. So again, long and short, studied, did the prerequisites for that, passed the board exam in 2020, and haven't looked back and have enjoyed the lifestyle medicine journey ever since.
What exactly does that involve? Give us a thumbnail sketch of how that's different from what you were doing before, if you would, Joe.
You betcha. Well, so lifestyle medicine focuses on evidence-based interventions that look at lifestyle choices and behaviors that people have with respect to their chronic diseases. So preventing, treating, and managing a chronic disease. The six pillars, and maybe it would be useful for the listeners to hear about those. And again, these are the things that we focus on when we're looking at kind of the whole person that comes in. The pillars are nutrition, so diet and nutrition, and that's probably the largest impact on chronic disease. We are big fans of predominantly whole food, plant-based eating. This isn't veganism, but we do know people who eat this way do the best. The second pillar, and we can go over these in more detail. The second pillar would be physical activity. The third would be sleep. And again, in no particular order at this point. Then there would be stress management, avoidance of risky substances. And then we also know, and the last one, we know the importance of healthy social connections, because people who are lonely have a poor health outlook. So those are the six pillars that we look at. And so instead of just looking at somebody with hypertension and treating that kind of in isolation, we look at all the factors that could be contributing to that and educate people and help them understand how they might make some interventions along those pillars, if you will, and how that might impact their disease. And then we have a variety of supports available for them. We really leverage a team approach. And so in our office, we have an RN that I work with on a regular basis. We also have an RN who has national board certification in health coaching, so really understands the science of behavior change very well. We're lucky enough to have our own physical therapist in our office. And then we have somebody who can help with behavioral health resource navigating if that's needed as well. So that's a big nutshell, but that's maybe how lifestyle medicine approach to taking care of patients maybe differs from traditional.
So the difference is a person comes into your office, and in the past, they might have obvious, you know, they're out of condition or they're overweight or any of those things that lead to difficulties, and you would just address that they have a cold right then. But now you might say to them, let's look at your whole picture and let's deal with these other issues that might be contributing. Do I maybe have that right?
I think that's a really good synopsis of it. And I will say in primary care and in family practice, internal medicine, pediatrics, we have always tried to do that, look at these other things and make suggestions. I think the difference with lifestyle medicine is I now have more tools at my disposal from a knowledge base and developing resources of a team that we can really help people look at these things and really make changes and develop some self-efficacy on their own end to, you know, continue that process. Whereas, like I said before, it would be like, well, and we see this all the time, you really should lose 10% of your body weight. You should this, you should that. And again, you folks probably know the kind of the art and science of behavior change. To just tell somebody to do something really isn't very effective if we're hoping to have them affect a change for their lives. It's a bit more nuanced than that.
It's almost like you're asking them to dismiss their comfort level with what they're currently doing and try another avenue. And change, as Arliss has pointed out, the psychologist over the years, is difficult for anyone. So you, in your innovative practice, are trying to truly assist them in every aspect you can of this change that might be needed.
Yeah, that really summarizes it well. That's the biggest thing. So the folks I see that are able to impact their health the most are ones who are able to, with appropriate guidance and resources, decide that they want to make some changes, because it's really about that, right? They have to find their own internal motivation for change. It doesn't come externally. And so that's really some of the fun part of it, is to explore their goals for their healthcare. And we talk about things with kind of sitting with ambivalence there. They will often be like, on one hand, I like cheeseburgers, but on the other hand, I know the cheeseburger isn't good for my heart, and I have a very strong family history of heart disease. And so we kind of just sit there with that rather than trying to tell them what they need to do. We have discussions with them and hope that ultimately they come to the decision themselves to make the change, and then we can help support that.
Do you refer people to different specialists in those areas, or do you manage like these six pillars from your perspective, your office? How do you go about that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I can't be an expert in all of these pillars. From the nutrition end, I really enjoy doing a lot of that. So I spend a fair bit of time doing that counseling. But again, I'm not a nutritionist, so we will utilize their resources for sure. Mentioned that we have a physical therapist in our office. And so when folks are deconditioned and they just do not know where to start, you know, safely with a physical activity program, that would be a referral base. And again, as you know, Arliss, you know, folks who have significant behavioral health, mental health issues, boy, if you don't take care of some of those things, it's going to be so hard to address the others. I can help with that a little bit with some stress reduction strategies and recommendations. But again, I'm not a psychologist or psychiatrist. So sometimes we will utilize our behavioral health resource navigator to get them plugged in with the appropriate people. So the answer is absolutely. It's a team-based approach. We have some of that embedded team within our lifestyle medicine clinic. And this isn't in isolation to other medical specialties, right? This isn't saying we're only going to focus on this. There is absolutely and will always be a role for the traditional medical approach to things. I mean, if somebody has known heart disease, they need to be on a statin at this point. And so it's not a substitute for the standard evidence-based medical care.
Are there group support systems available for this kind of thing?
Well, great question. We're, I would say, a bit in our infancy in this program. It's been up and running for a little over a year now, and I have a list of goals and ideas for our program, and having group visits and group support is definitely on that. At this point, we unfortunately don't, but boy, I think it could be so powerful when you hear some of the stories for people who have had successes, and if they could share those with others to see what is really possible, and then also to be able to just share the challenges that you're going through making these changes. You know, it just normalizes. You don't feel like you're an outcast or that you don't have ability to make change, but you get to hear everybody else's struggle with it. So that's a great idea.
In one study I read, I think out of the Mayo Clinic, 50% of Americans, I wish that were higher, that's 50%, said that wellness is a priority. And the three they listed were sleep, mindfulness, which I equate with stressors, and fitness. So I think at least half of the people are aware. We need to really raise that level of accountability and acceptance that we need to pay attention to this. So part of what you might have to provide might be the motivation and the setup to attempt these changes.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think what you're talking about there is those people who are in that contemplative stage of change. So they kind of are realizing that there might be a better way to do things, and they're thinking about that. And so if I can get somebody in the office in that contemplation stage, then we can oftentimes help them move into the preparation and action phase of that. You did mention, and this is really kind of nuanced and maybe a little semantical, but I think you might have said something like, I have to give them the motivation or something along those lines. It really ultimately has to be tapping into their own internal motivation. Now, we can provide some guidance and even accountability with follow-up visits and things like that, but they ultimately do these things because they find their own internal motivation. And we ask a lot of questions. You know, people will come in and say, I want to be healthier. I mean, well, why? Well, I just want to feel better. Like, why? Like, what are the whys behind the changes that you want to make? And when you start digging deeper, it's, you know, I have 3 grown kids and I have 6 grandchildren and I adore them and I want to be able to have a long, good health span so I can continue to do that. And I think when people get more granular about why they want to make these changes, then it's ultimately easier for them to, you know, tap into that motivation to make those changes.
Yes, I can certainly see that. And one aspect for those in that category you just mentioned is not only do you get to perhaps stay longer and have better health and energy to interact with your family, you also set the model for them of what to do as you get older. Do you just cave in to all of these excesses that we love so much? Or do you present a model for your children and your grandchildren to look toward as they get older? So everything we do is, I think, pretty much noticed by our families, and maybe that's a motivating factor as well.
Well, you know, that was a goosebump moment for me. I decided whenever I have those, I'm just going to share them because I think you're just hitting the nail so right on the head. I've coined a phrase. I have to go look it up and make sure that I'm not plagiarizing somebody else, but I call it lifestyle contagiosum. Because I've seen it so many times in just the last year and a bit that we've been doing this program where somebody will come in and, you know, they're having successes and then they share, oh yes, and my spouse has also lost 15 pounds over the last 3 months, you know, and it wasn't my patient. So as opposed to me having somebody come in and giving them a pill for their cholesterol or their hypertension, it will just treat those. But when we give them these tools and resources, they can spread that to, well, who knows how many people. And that's really rewarding to see that. I have one particular patient I'm thinking of who I think I've taken care of since I got here 25 years ago and has struggled with weight and prediabetes. And I'd had all these previous conversations in the past and boy, the needle just wasn't moving. And I really had resigned to, well, this is just going to be this person's lot in life. And as I learned more and had the tools to have different types of conversations with this patient, all of a sudden I started to see her making these changes. And when I dug into the why with her a bit, it was like you had mentioned, she lives with her daughter and her granddaughter, and she does a lot of the caregiving for the granddaughter as the daughter's working. And she really wants to be there for her granddaughter, but she also wants to set that example for her. And it's just so neat to hear her stories about them cooking together, making healthy choices together, going for walks, and then also just to see how her health has improved. So it's pretty special.
That leads to another one of my questions. In your estimation, is there any point in life at which it's too late to go ahead and try for health and wellness?
Oh my gosh. You know, it's like we've already had a conversation before and you're just teeing me up. So I appreciate the question. The answer to that, no, it's never too late. And I can give one example that maybe has a little more detail in it. So it was the beginning of 2022. There was a meta-analysis. So, right, bringing together of multiple studies to try to gain more information and power from the statistics. And it was on nutrition. And nutrition studies are traditionally very hard to do. It's hard to really control for things. In medicine, we have this randomized, double-blind, controlled study. And it's almost impossible to do that with nutrition. But in any case, they brought together a bunch of studies. And they looked at varying ages of people and the changes you might make. And this was primarily nutrition. And so, as an example, if you went from the SAD diet, and if you and your listeners know, that stands for the Standard American Diet, so it's a pretty interesting abbreviation for it.
Yes.
If you move the needle from the Standard American Diet to one that would be considered more optimal, and again, more towards that whole food, plant-based eating with, you know, some healthy animal proteins and things like that. If you did that at age 20 and you were a man, you added 10 years to your life. I'm sorry, a man added 13 years to your life, a woman added 10. Okay, well, that's early starting. What if you did it at 60? If you did it at age 60, you added 8 years to your life. And if you did it at age 80, you added 3.5. So again, based on that study, it's never too late.
Yes, I remember one patient I was working with. I worked with swallowing and eating, and he was 99, and he came to our rehab facility. He'd been healthy, but he'd fallen kind of to the wayside, and he actually even had a feeding tube, had to be fed through a tube in his tummy, and he had given up. Harry was his name, and he had turned his face to the wall, and Diane and I, my cohort, went in and said, "Get up, Harry, come on." And it took several months, but we got Harry back off that feeding tube and back to eating normal foods all the way back. And he was also in physical therapy all at age 99.
Wow.
We actually got together with his nephew who lived there in town, who helped find a beautiful apartment in a senior living facility where he had independence, but could also go downstairs to a nice dining room and eat good meals and socially interact when he wished. But my favorite part of the story is almost 3 years later, the front page of the newspaper in that town where we lived had a picture of Harry at his favorite pub where he always went to play pool at 103, playing pool with his buddies. So, you know, that's just one story, but it's one of my favorites.
Oh, my gosh. Thanks for sharing that. That really just drives that point home that it is, it's just really never too late. You know, and I think also, as I'm thinking about Harry, was his name Harry, did you say?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Harry. You know, he obviously still must have had that, you know, some lust for life. And you guys were able to help him tap into that. I think as we start getting a bit older, I think we start thinking about those things a bit more. We're not invincible like we thought we were in our 20s and 30s. We start wondering what this maybe next half of our life's going to be like, you know, God willing, if you're going to have those extended years. And you know, and people will often come into the office and say, "Oh, yeah, just getting older." And I'll look at them, I'm like, "Well, what are you doing about that, you know? Do you want to fight the good fight? Because you can't impact it if you want. You can let aging happen to you, or you can say, I'm going to do everything I can to hedge the bet in my favor." So, and I think, you know, you mentioned some of those statistics in the beginning in the introduction. I think they're all just so spot on, and that could be a whole nother radio show just talking about that, how we decide to deliver our medical care. But I came across a saying here recently that was really pretty interesting, that in the United States, we're actually not living longer, we're dying longer. And when
so
you
true.
Let that sit in, I mean, it's really true, right? We may have extended lifespan, but we have not at all extended health span. And I think most of us, I would venture to say pretty much all of us, what we really desire is a nice, long health span as opposed to a lifespan. I don't think anyone wants to spend the last X number of years of their life with significant disability from chronic disease and in and out of the hospital and doctor's offices. And not that this is, not that lifestyle medicine is the insurance policy to make sure that won't happen at all, but it does help you hedge the bet in your favor without a question.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's a spectacular point, Dr. Joe. And I found that some of the highest percentages of ageism can be found among older people who buy into the thought that they can't make changes now. It's too late in their lives, and that's just not the case. So, and for those out there listening, I was wondering if you would mind, we'll do it now, but let's do it again later. If somebody wants, a lot of times they might have a pencil waiting to write down a contact point. And if you could give us a phone number, location, email, just so that those hearing this would be able to reach out and maybe think about some of this change we're talking about here.
Yeah, well, you bet. So I'm currently practicing with Bozeman Health at the Cottonwood Clinic. So that's on the corner of Cottonwood and Huffine. The structure of my practice currently is I have my own continuity patients, and I'm doing consulting work for other providers in the Valley who have patients who are interested in engaging in this. So at this point, it's generally a referral base from that that person's, your listener's, primary care provider. But they can get a hold and get more information at our clinic. Our phone number is 406-414-4100. Now, that's going to get you into just schedulers, but they can get messages back to us. And we can always help facilitate conversation with the primary care providers, you know, to assist with referrals. But what I often recommend is that patients will go to the primary care provider if this is something they think they're interested in, and kind of ask for the referral from that person, because we wouldn't really be taking over a person's care. It's a it's a program that we have set up to help augment and be alongside of the standard care that they might be getting from the primary care provider.
I just think this program is so much what is needed and what we all need to consider strongly. And so I think, too, part of what you have said in your pillars that you address is a common complaint that we've run across, your sleep efforts. And I'd like, if you wouldn't mind, we could talk about sleep and what impact that has on general health and wellness, and why it might be significant.
Well, yeah, I agree. And I remember it was before I started this program, I met with a few different subspecialists in our community, and one was our sleep doc. And he looked me straight in the eye and said, "Joe, if I hear your pillars, if you don't take care of the sleep part, nothing else is going to matter." And so, again, I think that's true. I mean, these pillars are all very important, but if somebody has very disturbed sleep, the impact it has on their health is really tremendous. I mean, you know, poor sleep impacts so many different disease processes, you know, from our immune system to our mental health to cancer risk to heart disease to diabetes and obesity. So it's got a dramatic impact. And you could get into the science of it. You know, like with obesity, we have neurohormones that help regulate our hunger and our satiety, our sense of fullness. Well, when we have disrupted sleep, they totally go out of balance, leading us more towards, you know, weight gain and obesity. So the actual science behind it is really fascinating. You know, the standard recommended recommendations for sleep, you know, for an average adult is in the 7 to 9 hour range. And as we get older, it's a little bit less in the 7 to 8 hour range. And it's an important pillar. And I have patients kind of categorize or qualify their sleep. You know, how many hours do they get and how would they rate their sleep? And if it's not meeting the recommended goals, and if they think it's poor quality sleep, then we really dive into that quite a bit more. I think the biggest impact on sleep these days has to be related to stress. I think you had mentioned work with mindfulness and things like that. And I just think that's so important. And so many of us don't know how to turn off that reptilian hamster wheel brain of ours. We just let it do its thing. So we spend a fair bit of time talking about that. And I've even started to do just really kind of brief introductions into mindfulness work and some breath work, you know, even the office. And to the tune of sometimes we'll turn the lights off and do a little of the 4-7-8 breathing or progressive muscle relaxation breathing to just show people, you know, how this can impact your ability to relax and potentially improve sleep. But yeah, it's so important. We do spend a fair bit of time on it.
For some reason, what you're saying reminds me of our current time of existence with the social media and people who are called influencers. And we're always reading about someone who has all of their fame from being on TikTok or Instagram or Twitter, and they're influencing others, and that's their main identity, not that they were well known before that. But I'm thinking historically about how we've had, at least I recall from history, that Franklin D. Roosevelt used to have what he called fireside chats. And that was, of course, during the war, I think World War II, and around that time. But if somehow someone who was well known and had a regularity of their visits with, let's say, the American people, and it could be 5 minutes, 3 minutes, not long at all, but provide kind of a challenge and to influence people's health and with using those six pillars, for example. And of course, I know we have a lot of division politically, and so some people just turn off anybody who would want to be an influencer because they're identified as blue or red. But at least they'd have half the population, whoever did it. But could talk about, you know, these things and make challenges. I recall I was in junior college years ago when John F. Kennedy challenged Americans to 50-mile hikes. And it really turned a lot of us on. There were some of us who went from thinking about it to doing it, like leaving Altus, Oklahoma, walking to Lawton, Oklahoma, which is about 50 miles. A young man and I, a friend of mine, got up at 3 a.m., and we walked until 6 p.m. and almost made it. I think we cheated. We did cheat by getting a ride for the last 10 miles. I hate to tell that part. But one part of it was that we got into a hailstorm that came as we were walking, and we wanted to get out of it. But anyway, if we had someone on a regular basis that's well thought of, and it could be the young people influencing other young people, to really look at it, rather than what dress you're wearing, what makeup you're wearing, what exact physique you have, what your interests are socially, to actually throw in the positive stuff that you're talking about. And I know that when Suzanne and I, we'd like just go to the Y before COVID, we're trying to get back in, but we were in an exercise class of weightlifting. And people were a little bit wondering about, we're much older than most of the rest of the class. But it worked out beautifully. We went twice a week. We did that. We used to run 5Ks. We've done half marathons in the past. COVID really took a big bite out of that. Have you noticed that, for example? I'm jumping topics here, but did COVID did you notice a lot of negativity in your program after that or during that?
Oh, yeah, you know, for sure. And I would say, you know, COVID hit before we had the formal program going. But I saw its impact in a variety of different ways. One would be from just neurocognitive health. I had patients that I've cared for years who I had a sense that they had some mild cognitive impairment. And that's not uncommon as we get older. Probably half of 80-year-olds have some mild cognitive impairment. But I saw people precipitously drop off with respect to their cognitive abilities. And some people over the course of just a couple of years went from mild cognitive impairment to really more full-blown dementia. And I think a lot of that was the social isolation that came with that. You know, I think there's other factors as well, but I think that was a really big one. I mean, you mentioned going to the Y, you know, and lifting weights and doing those things. Well, that was great physical activity, but you also had the connection with others there, which is really critically important. And that's why we have that included as one of the pillars. And then, you know, I think college students often joke about the freshman 10. Well, there is the COVID 10 or 20 where, again, people were, their just habits changed so much. Their physical activity went down because maybe they weren't going to the gym. They were eating because of stress, so maybe they were ordering out more, whatever. But I saw a significant weight gain in population, too. So it definitely had a significant impact. You know, and then back to your comments about influencers. Boy, I think that, well, you're hitting the nail on the head. And I don't know who those people would be, and I'm not really plugged into social media. Love the idea about the fireside chat. I don't know if Mr. Biden, President Biden, can do that, but you know, he's got he has the cancer moonshot, so he wants to, you know, put all these efforts into curing cancer. Boy, when you know that 40% of cancers are directly linked to lifestyle choices, there might be a way to focus on some of these pillars that would have more potential impact on the occurrence of cancer. So rather than catching it on the back end, you know, what can we do on the front end? You know, and what things really drive our sense of well-being? It's really, when it comes to the end of the day, it's not the pair of sneakers I'm wearing or the car that I'm driving. I mean, it's these these other things that really are, I think, just more important to people on that real core level.
Couldn't agree more. And while Arliss was talking, I did write down Dr. Sofianek weekly fireside chat.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, we'll be talking to you again about that.
Okay.
Okay. Because that is a, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, I'd say that I'm not plugged into social media, and you get all these ideas when you're starting out these new programs. I'm like, boy, wouldn't it be great to figure out a way to get this message out to as many people as possible? It just takes time. That's all.
And, you know, there's another aspect in our audience of folks. For instance, we had a veteran on the show a while back who was suffering from PTSD and traumatic stress from his time in Afghanistan and all of those places. And it was impacting his life in a very specific way. When he was sleeping, would have nightmares about what happened. And he talked about how when he was in this nightmare, it released very bad, much like we use endorphins that are positive, there were negative responses of his body to these nightmares that were becoming so intense that it was affecting his heart and really beginning to make him ill. And they discovered this, I guess, through sleep studies and all at the Veterans Hospital. They actually got him a therapy dog who was trained to recognize eye movement when he was having dreams and reach up and wake him up.
Wow, that's amazing.
And so I guess by virtue of that story, I'm trying to say, for whatever reason you're having difficulty reaching these six pillars, let's maybe look into that, and that there might be some real help available, even in very unusual, unexpected ways, that these groups trying to achieve wellness for you would really love to explore. And so I guess that was just one thing that was telling me your sleep is so significant in so many ways, and also very bad experiences during sleep can be quite negative. So coming to your clinic or working to achieve a change here would be significant.
Yeah, I think very well stated. And it highlights the importance of the fact that there are multiple things, right, that can impact quality of sleep and these other pillars. And it's also the importance of looking at your approach to these things as the whole person and a really individualized approach. It's not a cookie cutter approach. And it does, without a doubt, take expertise from a bunch of different folks who can weigh in on these things.
I noticed, I'm more or less retired, but I do some veterans evaluations, pardon me, and disability evaluations for the state and the VA. And almost, I'd say virtually every veteran I talk to in the setting I'm seeing them, because they've been referred, obviously, for a mental health issue, I would say, and I don't think I'm exaggerating, 95% to 97% of them, when I ask them to just answer yes or no, or to describe their sleeping, and they most of them say it's awful. And then if I ask what their energy level is, and which goes with it, I have very low energy. So sleeping is, I agree with you and the other doc you talked about, that having positive, restful sleep is at the center of a lot of positive change, if you can do it. But yes, sleeping boosts energy and exercise. Suzanne and I have found that I hear a number of people say, well, that's very tiring and I need my energy to do something else. But when we exercise, and I think it's true of virtually everyone, We have more energy, not less.
That's a great point. You know, you have to believe in it. You have to make that investment because it does pay off. There's a stress curve, a stress performance curve. It's a bell-shaped curve, and it'd be better if I could do this visually with you folks. But basically, it's stress on the horizontal axis and performance or productivity on the vertical, and it's a bell-shaped curve. We would all do best to be on the left side of that curve, so when our stress increases, we can increase productivity, if you're following. Yes. But my point in bringing this up is you can change the shape of your curve when you do good things for yourself. So like exercising, like getting your sleep, changes your ability to deal with stress, and you have increased performance and productivity.
We've certainly found that to be true. And it's always a hassle to do your daily exercises, and you fuss about it. But going ahead and doing them is kind of the key to all the rest of your day. And I think people also make the mistake. Someone said to me yesterday, well, I walk around all the time at my job. You know, I get up and walk a lot. And my take on that is that work uses up our energy, and exercise gives us back our energy. So there's a difference between work and energy, and you get so much more productive energy when you exercise regularly.
Yeah, I think you're a great spokeswoman for that. And again, also hitting the nail on the head with that one. And I think, you know, another piece of this as I start thinking about it, and the real beauty of this is when you can chat with folks and get them a place where they want to make these changes, and they do, they start feeling better so quickly. It's really amazing. I'll see people back at a 6-week follow-up, and they're like, my mind is clearer, I have more energy, I'm sleeping better, if they're able to really embrace these changes. It doesn't take months or years to start seeing the benefits. They literally, within weeks, can start seeing the return on their investment in taking care of themselves.
It's kind of like a term I've always liked is inertia, emotional inertia, physics term, the inertia part. But it's like when a body is at rest, it tends to remain at rest. And when emotion tends to remain in motion. But the if only is that question, that space between the intellectual and the activity is, I know what to do. It's just hard to do it. But if you can just get it started somehow, and that's where influencers and people having their own private reasons for getting motivated to do it, if you can get it rolling, get your activity going, it feeds into itself in a positive way, and you want to keep doing it. And so if one can get into the emotional inertia by getting the ball rolling, you're likely to continue it for a time.
Yeah, well, because you start seeing those positive results. This might be an opportunity to just maybe give a suggestion to the listeners about getting from that intellectually, right? That's that contemplation stage to that action stage. Arles, I don't know if the trans-theoretical model for change is something that you work with, but again, it's that pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, maintenance, whatnot. But I think there's an interesting, pretty simple tool that I'll often suggest to people when they're in that place of thinking about wanting to make that change. And it's to set a SMART goal, which is an acronym. And so a SMART goal for somebody, we can just go over it if we have a little time. It's the S stands for SMART, the M for measurable, the A for achievable or actionable, the R would be relevant, and the T would be time-based. And so as an example, when somebody comes into my office and they have change talk, they're like, I would like to start exercising more. I think it would be better for my body. I'd probably feel better. And they're like, but, you know, I don't know how to start. So if they're at a point where it seems like they're ready to make a plan, I'll ask them, you know, are you prepared? It seems like you're really interested in this. Are you prepared to make a plan? And we'll go over the SMART goal. And well, I actually write it down in their chart, and I let them ultimately decide what the goal is, but I would give them an example. So for your listeners, a SMART goal for physical activity could be something like, I'm going to start walking. I would like to do 2 days a week for 30 minutes each time. I'm going to start it next Saturday, and I'm going to do it on Tuesdays and Thursdays because that's when I have the most time. I know this is good for myself and for my heart, and I'm going to make sure I have a pair of walking shoes by the door so I can facilitate doing it. So it gets very granular and specific, and then at the end of your time frame, let's say 2 weeks, you look back and say, I did. I got out twice a week over the last 2 weeks. I did that. What would I like to do next? And set yourself another SMART goal and track it. And if you didn't hit your goal, look back, and we don't beat ourselves up about it. We look back and say, well, I got out 3 out of the 4 times that I planned. What happened on that fourth time? What happened in life? Was there a curveball that got thrown that I didn't anticipate? What were the potential barriers? And you learn from that and then use that information moving forward. Because I think making changes are most of us are best done in small, discrete chunks that layer on top of themselves rather than trying to, pivot 180 degrees. I mean, there's some people who do that. But for most of us, I think sustainable change is best done with these smaller SMART goals, if you will.
I remember in my mid-50s, I thought, I've never really done exercise. I really need to do something. And I just stepped outside the door. And we had a little park right across the street from the house. And if you walked around it, it was about 1 mile. And so I just walked around that. It was very pleasant. Went early in the morning before work and all that. And after a while, it seemed like, I could run a few steps here. So I'd walk, run. And then after a while, it became easier to run and quicker. You'd get there sooner than walking. And it was so fun. And you felt so much better to start your day that way. And we even did a few 5Ks. And not to win, just to get in there with the group and have fun. It really was fun. You think sometimes you're going to, of course, expire right on the spot, but it's very invigorating. And then, I'll be doggone, when I was 64, we were heading down to New Orleans to do a 5K for my birthday, and I accidentally got in the wrong lane somehow. Arliss did this same thing. And I was running along and said to the lady chugging next to me, "Is this the 5K? Because I'd been running a long time by then." And she said, "Oh, no, honey, you're in the marathon."
Oh, my goodness.
And I didn't know what to do. I'm in my shorts in the middle of New Orleans, no phone, no money. Made me so mad, I just decided to keep going. And I walked a few steps, and that just didn't work. I ran that half marathon.
Wow.
And I just want to submit that if a 64-year-old Grammy can accidentally do a half marathon, most anybody could do this. I have never been, an athlete at all. And after that, we've done 9 more half marathons. So you just don't ever know what you can do. Just start out walking.
That's so inspirational. Accidental inspiration. That's fantastic.
Man. It was hilarious.
It's that little bit of that piece, right? It's, don't do nothing because you can't do it all.
Exactly.
Right? Start, people can get so incapacitated by thinking it's all just too big. But right, just put your shoes on. Just eat the healthy breakfast today.
Yeah.
Just say hi to the clerk and interact with them when you're checking out the grocery store. Just do something. And again, it just starts to feel good like you experienced.
And one post note to that, our grandson's first 5K was with us. And then after all that happened, his first half marathon was with us. So that was a really special part of it.
And he got into track and did very well. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. And he will carry that on to his family when he's older. You know, that's the lifestyle contagiosum, you know, in full force right there.
Well, we cannot thank you enough for your work, and we applaud your efforts. And we've got some time left here, but we'd like once more for you to give the coordinates for how to reach you, because we're hoping many people in the audience out there will be wanting to begin this journey or enhance this journey, and your program is a real conduit for that. Would you mind going over that again, please, Dr. Joe?
You bet, you bet. So again, I work at Bozeman Health Cottonwood Clinic. It's out on the west end of town. And then really the best way for folks to get in touch with me and get set up with a referral to our program is really going to ultimately be through their primary care physician. And if for whatever reason, I think we have advertised this a good bit, but if they're unaware of how to do that, they can always reach out to our office and get a referral going, and then we would reach out to them and get that scheduled. Again, our phone number is 406-414-4100, but the best way for them to get kind of rolling with this program would be through their primary care provider, who also has a lot of this information too. And if they have time to dive into this type of stuff, then great. But if not, we're glad to help out and be a resource for lifestyle change.
Well, you know, when we read statistics like this one, that more than half of the world's people will be obese by 2035, that's concerning. And sadly, and this is something I was going to ask you to address with us, the most rapidly rising number among that group is children and teenagers who are rapidly gaining in obesity. Do you also work with younger folks, Dr. Joe?
You know, as a family practice doctor, I see the whole spectrum. Specifically for this program, I started it off with just the adult population, but absolutely realized the importance of addressing this in our younger population, because, yeah, we're seeing obesity, we're seeing type 2 diabetes in teenagers. It's really unfortunate. Again, we could talk another time about why that might be and what's going on with our food delivery system and those type of things. At this point, I'm not seeing the pediatric population. We are, however, working, and this is through Bozeman Health, through our community outreach folks. They have set up a stakeholder group, so there must be at least 15 to 20 different representatives from various organizations within the Valley and in our community who have interest in this arena, and specifically with kids and young families and trying to help improve health from, again, the healthy lifestyle choices, and have just submitted a grant to No Kids Hungry. We're optimistic that we're going to get that. And it's a program that's called 5-2-1-0, and that stands for 5 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables per day, no more than 2 hours of non-productive screen time a day, 1 hour of physical activity, and zero added sugary drinks during the day. So we are working on it. I'm not specifically addressing that in my clinic, but working on that on a community level because it's certainly important.
That's good to hear, Jan. It's interesting that most debilitating diseases are preventable.
80%. That's what we would say. You know, we have genetics. Here's a saying, and it's maybe good as we get towards the end of our hour, but the one of the sayings in lifestyle medicine is that genetics loads the gun, but lifestyle pulls the trigger. And so just because you have this strong family history of X, Y, or Z, it does not dictate what's going to happen to you. You have lots of influence over it. And again, then the science of that's fascinating with epigenetics and how things we do or don't do to our body alter the way our DNA and genes are expressed. It's really fascinating science, but we definitely can impact our health by optimizing our lifestyle choices.
I wonder, we don't have a lot of time left. Could you briefly go over that breathing exercise, the 478. Just for anybody out there, here's a really good quick tip for a method that helps.
Oh, yeah, that's great. So if people are listening, they want to do it. So I would encourage them to find a place to sit that's comfortable. It doesn't have to be on a meditation cushion. It could be just in a comfortable chair with your kind of feet on the floor and your hands on your lap, and you could turn your palms up if you want. And if you like, you could turn the lights out. And so it's a breathing technique. It's called 478, and I'll describe it, and then maybe people can do it as I do the counting. And so it's a inhalation on a four count. It's holding your breath on inhalation for a seven count, and then it's exhaling for an eight count. And so if people want to do it, you could close your eyes and then begin to breathe in. One, two, three, four. Hold your breath. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. And now exhale. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. And then you would simply repeat that. And you could do that a handful of times. Most people find it relaxing just after a couple breaths. Deep breathing is used in a variety of different things for a reason, because it works. So it's used in lamas and yoga and meditation, again, because there is science behind it, if you will. It engages your parasympathetic nervous system, which is the opposite part of the nervous system to your sympathetic, and that's what's activated when we're anxious or worried or scared, or our mind just turned on in the middle of the night. So this helps us counter that with a part of our nervous system that lowers blood pressure, lowers heart rate, and helps us neurologically relax.
Yes, I read one person saying about it that when you are holding your breath, that allows those chemicals in your body to be released that are relaxation-type chemicals. So that's your golden time during that sleep or relaxation exercise, that deep breath followed by the seven count, that helps release the chemicals. So after you've done it a few times, you begin to feel much more relaxed and at ease. And it's a great exercise.
Anyone's having trouble turning their mind off and relaxing, like, that's an easy, great place to start.
We have about a minute and a half. Give us some final words of wisdom here.
Goodness gracious. Final words of wisdom would be that you have more control of your health and well-being than you think you might initially have. Everybody has it within them to make these changes. They can sometimes feel daunting at times, and it can also be confusing to know where to start, because there is so much stuff out there on the internet and social media, and sometimes hard to sort through these things. These pillars that we've gone over today, there's science and evidence behind all of these and how they can impact your health. And you could certainly do some of that research on your own. But again, meeting with your primary care provider to talk about these things that seem like they resonate with you. You know your body the best, and deep down intuitively, you probably know where it is that you'd like to start. And so listen to that. And then if you need further assistance, again, reaching out to your medical support system, and we'd be happy to help with that in our lifestyle medicine clinic as well. And kind of like we said before, that adage of don't do nothing because you can't do it all, I think really rings true. Have confidence in yourself, because everybody has the ability to make change. Dig into your why, really be honest with yourself about that. Because when you know your why and you believe it, the how part is so much easier.
Dr. Joe, thank you so much. This is KGVM Health and Happiness. Listen to our program regularly. Thank you.